Chapter 9. No why, no how, then what. They marched in, single file. Not a word was spoken. No one made any eye contact with anyone else. They all looked the same, their heads shaved, their clothes gray and tattered, their boots dusty. One by one, they filled a large cavernous room, like a hangar from a science fiction movie. The only color was gray. The walls were gray. Dust and smoke filled the space, even making the air look gray. Hundreds, maybe even thousands of these drone people sat on neatly organized benches. Row after row after row, a sea of gray conformity. They all watched a projection of a huge talking head on the screen in front of the room that filled the entire wall. This apparent leader recited dogma and propaganda, stating loudly that they were in complete control. They had achieved perfection. They were free of pests, or so they thought. Running down one of the tunnels that led into the cavernous hangar, a lone blonde woman. She wore bright red shorts and a crisp white t-shirt. Like a lighthouse, her complexion and the color of her clothes seemed to shine through the gray air. Pursued by security, she ran with a sledgehammer. This would not end well for the status quo. On January 22, 1984, Apple launched their Macintosh computer with their now-famous commercial depicting an Orwellian scene of a totalitarian regime holding control over a population and promised that 1984 won't be like 1984. But this advertising was much more than just advertising. It was not about features and benefits of a new product. It was not about a differentiating value proposition, even. It was, for all intents and purposes, a manifesto, a poetic ode to Apple's why. It was the film version of an individual rebelling against the status quo, igniting a revolution. And though their products have changed and fashions have changed, this commercial is as relevant today as it was when it first aired 25 years ago. And that's because a why never changes. What you do can change with the times, but why you do it never does. The commercial is one of the many things the company has done or said over the years to show or tell the outside world what they believe. All Apple's advertising and communications, their products, their partnerships, their packaging, their store design, they are all what's to Apple's why, proof that they actively challenge status quo thinking to empower the individual. Ever noticed that their advertising never shows groups enjoying their products? Always individuals? Their Think Different campaign depicted individuals who thought differently, never groups, always individuals. And when Apple tells us to think different, they are not just describing themselves. The ads showed pictures of Pablo Picasso, Martha Graham, Jim Henson, Alfred Hitchcock, to name a few, with the line, think different, on the upper right-hand side of the page. Apple does not embody the rebel spirit because they associated themselves with known rebels. They chose known rebels because they embody the same rebel spirit. The why came before the creative solution to the advertising. Not a single ad showed a group. This is no accident. Empowering the individual spirit is why Apple exists. Apple knows their why, and so do we. Agree with them or not, we know what they believe because they tell us. Speak clearly, and ye shall be clearly understood. An organization is represented by the cone in the three-dimensional view of the golden circle. This organized system sits atop another system, the marketplace. The marketplace is made up of all the customers and potential customers, all the press, the shareholders, and all the competition, suppliers, and all the money. This system is inherently chaotic and disorganized. The only contact that the organized system has with the disorganized system is at the base, at the what level. Everything an organization says and does communicates the leader's vision to the outside world. All the products and services that the company sells, all the marketing and all the advertising, they all work to communicate this to the outside world. If people don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. And if all the things happening at the what level do not clearly represent why the company exists, then the ability to inspire is severely complicated. When a company is small, this is not an issue. because the founder has plenty of direct contact with the outside world. Trusted how types may be in short supply, and the founder opts to make a majority of the big decisions him or herself. The founder or leader actually goes out and talks to customers, sells the product, and hires most, if not all, the new employees. As the company grows, however, systems and processes are added and other people will join. The cause embodied by an individual slowly morphs into a structured organization, and the cone starts to take shape. As it grows, the leader's role changes. He will no longer be the loudest part of the megaphone. He will become the source of the message that is to flow through the megaphone. When a company is small, it revolves around the personality of the founder. There is no debate that the founder's personality is the personality of the company. Why then do we think things change just because a company is successful? What's the difference between Steve Jobs the man and Apple the company? Nothing. What's the difference between Sir Richard Branson's personality and Virgin's personality? Nothing. As a company grows, the CEO's job is to personify the why, to ooze of it, to talk about it, to preach it, to be a symbol of what the company believes. They are the intention, and what the company says and does is their voice. Like Martin Luther King and his social movement, the leader's job is no longer to close all the deals, it is to inspire. As the organization grows, the leader becomes physically removed farther and farther away from what the company does, and even farther away from the outside market. I love asking CEOs what their biggest priority is, and, depending on the size or structure, I generally get one of two answers: customers or shareholders. Sadly, there aren't many CEOs of companies of any reasonable size who have daily contact with customers anymore. And customers and shareholders alike both exist outside the organization, in the chaotic world of the marketplace. Just as the cone demonstrates, the CEO's job, the leader's responsibility, is not to focus on the outside market, it's to focus on the layer directly beneath. How? The leader must ensure that there are people on the team who believe what they believe and know how to build it. The how types are responsible for understanding why and must come to work every day to develop the systems and hire the people who are ultimately responsible for bringing that why to life. The general employees are responsible for demonstrating the why to the outside world in whatever the company says and does. The challenge is that they are able to do it clearly. Remember the biology of the golden circle? The why exists in the part of the brain that controls feelings and decision-making, but not language. What's exist in the part of the brain that controls rational thought and language? Comparing the biology of the brain to the three-dimensional rendering of the golden circle reveals a profound insight. The leader sitting at the top of the organization is the inspiration, the symbol of the reason why we do what we do. They represent the emotional limbic brain. What the company says and does represents the rational thought and language of the neocortex. Just as it is hard for people to speak their feelings, like someone trying to explain why they love their spouse, it is equally hard for an organization to explain its why. The part of the brain that controls feelings and the part of the brain that controls language are not the same. Given that the cone is simply a three-dimensional rendering of the golden circle, which is firmly grounded in the biology of human decision-making, the logic follows that organizations of any size will struggle to clearly communicate their why. Translated into business terms, this means that trying to communicate your differentiating value proposition is really hard. Put bluntly, the struggle that so many companies have to differentiate or communicate their true values to the outside world is not in fact a business problem, it's a biology problem. And just like a person struggling to put her emotions into words, we rely on metaphors, imagery, and analogies in an attempt to communicate how we feel. Absent the proper language to share our deep emotions or purpose, cause, or belief, we tell stories. We use symbols. We create tangible things for those who believe what we believe to point to and say, "That's why I'm inspired." If done properly, that's what marketing, branding, and products and services become: a way for organizations to communicate to the outside world. Communicate clearly, and you shall be understood. Chapter 10. Communication is not about speaking, it's about listening. Martin Luther King Jr., a man who would become a symbol of the entire civil rights movement, chose to deliver his famous I have a dream speech in front of another symbol, the Lincoln Memorial. Like King, Lincoln stands, or in the case of the memorial, sits, as a symbol of the American value of freedom for all. Great societies understand the importance of symbols as a way of reinforcing their values, of capturing their beliefs. Dictators understand the importance of symbols all too well, but in their case, the symbols are usually of them and not of a larger belief. Symbols help us make tangible that which is intangible. And the only reason symbols have meaning is because we infuse them with meaning. That meaning lives in our minds, not in the item itself. Only when the purpose, cause, or belief is clear can a symbol command great power. The flag, for example, is nothing more than a symbol of our nation's values and beliefs. And we follow the flag into battle. That's some serious power. Ever notice the patch of the American flag on a soldier's right arm? It's backwards. There was no mistake made. It's like that on purpose. A flag flying on a staff, as any army was rushing into battle, would appear backwards if viewed from the right side. To put it the other way around on the right shoulder would appear as if the soldier were in retreat. Our flag is infused with so much meaning that some have tried to pass laws banning its desecration. It's not the material out of which the flag is sewn that these patriots aim to protect. The laws they propose have nothing to do with the destruction of property. Their goal is to protect the meaning the symbol represents, the why. The laws they drafted try to protect the intangible set of values and beliefs by protecting the symbol of those values and beliefs. Though the laws have been struck down by the Supreme Court, they have spurred contentious and emotionally charged debates. They pit our desire for freedom of expression with our desire to protect a symbol of that freedom. Ronald Reagan, the great communicator, knew all too well the power of symbols. In 1982, he was the first president ever to invite a hero to sit in the balcony of the House chamber during the State of the Union address, a tradition that has continued every year since. A man who exuded optimism, Reagan knew the value of symbolizing the values of America instead of just talking about them. His guest, who sat with the First Lady, was Lenny Skutnik, a government employee who had dived into the icy Potomac River just days before to save a woman who had fallen from a helicopter that was attempting to rescue her after an Air Florida plane crashed into the river. Reagan was trying to make a point that words are hollow, but deeds and values are deep. After he told Skutnik's story, he waxed, "Don't let anyone tell you that America's best days are behind her, that the American spirit has been vanquished. We've seen it triumph too often in our lives to stop believing in it now." Skutnik became Reagan's symbol of courage. Most companies have logos, but few have been able to convert these logos into meaningful symbols, because most companies are bad at communicating what they believe. So it follows that most logos are devoid of any meaning. At best, they serve as icons to identify a company and its products. A symbol cannot have any deep meaning until we know why it exists in terms bigger than simply to identify the company. Without clarity of why, a logo is just a logo. To say that a logo stands for quality, service, innovation, and the like only reinforces its status as just a logo. These qualities are about the company and not about the cause. Don't forget the dictators. They understand the power of symbols, except the symbols are often of them. Likewise, so many companies act like dictators. It's all about them and what they want. They tell us what to do. They tell us what we need. They tell us that they have the answers, but they do not inspire us and they do not command our loyalty. And to take the analogy a step further, the way dictators maintain power is through fear, reward, and every other manipulation they can think of. People follow dictators not because they want to, but because they have to. For companies to be perceived as great leaders and not dictators, all their symbols, including their logos, need to stand for something in which we can all believe, something we can all support. That takes clarity, discipline, and consistency. For a logo to become a symbol, people must be inspired to use that logo to say something about who they are. Couture fashion labels are the most obvious example of this. People use them to demonstrate status, but many of them are somewhat generic in what they symbolize. There is a more powerful and profound example, Harley Davidson. There are people who walk around with Harley Davidson tattoos on their bodies. That's insane. They've tattooed a corporate logo on their skin. Some of them don't even own the product. Why would rational people tattoo a corporate logo on their bodies? The reason is simple. After years of Harley being crystal clear about what they believe, after years of being disciplined about a set of values and guiding principles, and after years of being doggedly consistent about everything they say and do, their logo has become a symbol. It no longer simply identifies a company and its products, it identifies a belief. In truth, most people who tattoo Harley Davidson logos on their bodies have no idea the stock price of Harley. They have no idea about some management shakeup the week before. That symbol is no longer about Harley. The logo embodies an entire value set, their own. The symbol is no longer about Harley. It's about them. Randy Fowler, a former U.S. Marine and now general manager of a Harley Davidson dealership in California, proudly sports a large Harley tattoo on his left arm. It symbolizes who I am, he says. Mostly, it says, I'm an American. Customer and company are now one and the same. The meaning of Harley Davidson has value in people's lives because, for those who believe in Harley's why, it helps them express the meaning of their own lives. Because of Harley's clarity, discipline, and consistency, most of us will know what that symbol means, even if you don't subscribe to it yourself. That's the reason why, when someone walks into a bar with a big Harley logo on his arm, we take a step back and give him a wide berth. The symbol has become so meaningful, in fact, that 12% of Harley Davidson's revenues are strictly for merchandising. That's remarkable. It's not just logos, however, that can serve as symbols. Symbols are any tangible representation of a clear set of values and beliefs. An ink-stained finger for Iraqis was a symbol of a new beginning. A London double-decker bus or a cowboy hat, both are symbols of national cultures. But national symbols are easy because most nations have a clear sense of culture that has been reinforced and repeated for generations. It is not a company or organization that decides what its symbols mean. It is the group outside the megaphone, in the chaotic marketplace, who decide. If, based on the things they see and hear, the outsiders can clearly and consistently report what an organization believes, then, and only then, can a symbol start to take on meaning. It is the truest test of how effective a megaphone has been produced when clarity is able to filter all the way through the organization and come to life in everything that comes out of it. Go back to Apple's 1984 commercial at the beginning of Chapter 9. For those who have seen it, does it make you think about Apple and its products, or do you simply like the sentiment? Or the line, "Think different"? Does it speak to you? If you're a Mac customer, you probably loved this commercial. It may even give you goosebumps when you watch it, a surefire test that the why is connecting with you on a visceral or limbic level. In fact, this commercial, after you've learned it was from Apple, may have reinforced your decision to buy a Mac, whether for the first time or the 10th time. This commercial, like all Apple's advertising, is one of the things Apple has said or done that reinforces what they believe. It is every bit consistent with the clear belief we know they embody. And if the commercial speaks to you and you're not an Apple lover, odds are you still like the idea of thinking differently. The message of that ad is one of the things Apple does to tell their story. It is one of the what's to their why. It is a symbol. It is for these reasons that we say of a piece of advertising, quote, "It really speaks to me." It's not really speaking to you. It's speaking to the millions of people who saw the ad. When we say that something like that speaks to me, what we're really saying is, through all this clutter and noise, I can hear that. I can hear it and I will listen. This is what it means for a message that comes out of a megaphone to resonate. Everything that comes out of the base of the megaphone serves as a way for an organization to articulate what it believes. What a company says and does are the means by which the company speaks. Too many companies put a disproportionate amount of weight on their products or services simply because those are the things that bring in the money. But there are many more things at the base of the megaphone that play an equal role in speaking to the outside world. Though products may drive sales, they alone cannot create loyalty. In fact, a company can create loyalty among people who aren't even customers. I spoke favorably of Apple long before I bought one, and I spoke disparagingly of a certain PC brand, even though I'd been buying their product for years. Apple's clarity, discipline, and consistency, their ability to build a megaphone, not a company, that is clear and loud, is what has given them the ability to command such loyalty. They are accused of having a cult-like following. Those inside the company are often accused of following the cult of Steve. All of these compliments or insults are indications that others have taken on the cause and made it their own. That experts describe their product and marketing as a lifestyle reinforces that people who love Apple products are using what Apple does to demonstrate their own personal identity. We call it lifestyle marketing because people have integrated commercial products into the style of their lives. Apple, with great efficiency, built a perfectly clear megaphone, leveraged the law of diffusion, and invited others to help spread the gospel, not for the company, for themselves. Even their promotions and partnerships serve as tangible proof of what they believe. In 2003 and 2004, Apple ran a promotion for iTunes with Pepsi, the cola branded as the choice of the next generation. It made sense that Apple would do a deal with Pepsi, the primary challenger to Coca-Cola, the status quo. Everything Apple does, everything they say and do, serves as tangible proof of what they believe. The reason I use Apple so extensively throughout this book is that Apple is so disciplined in how they do things and so consistent in what they do that, love them or hate them, we all have a sense of why. We know what they believe. Most of us didn't read books about them. We don't personally know Steve Jobs. We haven't spent time roaming the halls of Apple's headquarters to get to know their culture. The clarity we have for what Apple believes comes from one place and one place only, Apple. People don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. And Apple says and does only the things they believe. If what you do doesn't prove what you believe, then no one will know your why. And you'll be forced to compete on price, service, quality, features, and benefits. The stuff of commodities. Apple has a clear and loud megaphone and is exceptionally good at communicating its story. The celery test. In order to improve how and what we do, we constantly look to what others are doing. We attend conferences, read books, talk to friends and colleagues to get their input and advice, and sometimes we are also the dispensers of advice. We are in pursuit of understanding the best practices of others to help guide us. But it is a flawed assumption that what works for one organization will work for another. Even if the industry's sizes and market conditions are exactly the same, the notion that if it's good for them, it's good for us, is simply not true. I know a company with an amazing culture. When asked, the employees say they love that all the conference rooms have ping pong tables in them. Does that mean if you were to put a ping pong table in all your conference rooms, your culture would improve? Of course not. But this is an example of best practices. The idea that copying what or how things are done at other high-performing organizations will inherently work for you is just not true. Like the Ferrari and the Honda, what is good for one person or one company is not necessarily good for another. Put simply, best practices are not always best. It is not just what or how you do things that matters. What matters more is that what and how you do things is consistent with your why. Only then will your practices indeed be best. There is nothing inherently wrong with looking to others to learn what they do. The challenge is knowing what practices or advice to follow. Fortunately, there is a simple test you can apply to find out exactly what and how is right for you. It's a simple metaphor called the celery test. Imagine you go to a dinner party and somebody comes up to you and says, "You know what you need in your organization? M&Ms. If you're not using M&Ms in your business, you're leaving money on the table." Somebody else comes up to you and says, "You know what you need? Rice milk. The data shows that all the people are buying rice milk these days. You should be selling rice milk in this economy." While you're standing over by the punch bowl, yet another person offers you some sage advice. "Oreo cookies," he says. "We made millions from implementing Oreos in our organization. You've got to do it." Still, somebody else comes up to you and says, "Celery. Gotta get into celery." You get all this great advice from all these highly accomplished people. Some of them are even in the same industry. Some of them are more successful than you. Some of them have offered similar advice to others with great success. Now what do? You go to the supermarket and you buy celery, rice milk, Oreos, and M&Ms. You spend a lot of time at the supermarket. You spend a lot of money at the supermarket because you bought everything. But you may or may not get any value from some or all of these products. There are no guarantees. Worse, if you're budget constrained, you had to whittle down your choices again. And then which did you choose? But one thing's for sure. When you're standing in line at the supermarket, with all these items in your arms, your celery, rice milk, Oreos, and M&Ms, nobody can see what you believe. What you do is supposed to serve as the tangible proof of what you believe, but you bought everything. But what if you knew your why before you went to the supermarket? What if your why is to do things that are healthy, to always do the things that are good for your body? You'll get all the same advice from all the same people. The only difference is, the next time you go to the supermarket, you'll only buy rice milk and you'll only buy celery. Those are the only two products that make sense. It's not that the other advice isn't good, it's just not good for you. The advice doesn't fit. Filtering your decisions through your why, you spend less time at the supermarket, you spend less money at the supermarket. So there's an efficiency advantage also. You're guaranteed to get value out of all the products you bought. And most importantly, when you're standing in line with your products in your arms, everyone can see what you believe. With only celery and rice milk, it's obvious to people walking by what you believe. I can see that you believe in looking after your health, they may say to you. I feel the same way. I have a question for you. Congratulations. You just attracted a customer, an employee, a partner, or a referral simply by making the right decisions. Simply ensuring that what you do proves what you believe makes it easy for those who believe what you believe to find you. You have successfully communicated your why based on what you do. This is an idealistic concept, and in the real world, that level of discipline is not always possible. I understand that sometimes we have to make short-term decisions to pay bills or get some sort of short-term advantage. That's fine. The celery test still applies. If you want a piece of chocolate cake, go right ahead. The difference is, when you start with why, you know full well that the chocolate cake is a short-term decision that doesn't fit with your beliefs. You're under no illusions. You know that you're doing it only for the short-term sugar rush, and you'll have to work a little harder to get it out of your system. It's astounding the number of businesses I see that view an opportunity as the one that's going to set them on a path to glory, only to have it blow up or slowly deflate over time. They see the chocolate cake and can't resist. Starting with why not only helps you know which is the right advice for you to follow, but also to know which decisions will put you out of balance. You can certainly make those decisions if you need to, but don't make too many of them. Otherwise, over time, no one will know what you believe. Here's the best part. As soon as I told you the why, you knew that we were only going to buy celery and rice milk even before I said it. As soon as I gave you the filter, as soon as I said the why, you knew exactly what decisions to make before I said so. That's called scale. With a why clearly stated in an organization, anyone within the organization can make a decision as clearly and as accurately as the founder. A why provides the clear filter for decision making. Any decisions, hiring, partnerships, strategies, and tactics should all pass the celery test. The more celery you use, the more trust you earn. Mark Rubin is a good parent. He spends a lot of time with his two daughters, Lucy and Sophie. One Saturday afternoon, his wife, Claudine, took Lucy to a friend's house for a playdate, and Mark was left home to look after the 5-year-old Sophie. Feeling a little tired, Mark really wanted to just have a little time to relax on the couch and not have to play treehouse again for the 9th time that day. To keep Sophie occupied, he opted for the TV as babysitter. Mark had 2 brand new DVDs to choose from. He'd seen neither of them and heard nothing about either of them in the press or from any of his friends with small children. Mark didn't feel like watching the cartoon himself. The plan was to let Sophie enjoy the movie in one room while he watched something else in the other room. One of the DVDs was from some company he'd never heard of. The other one was from Disney. Which one do you think he put in the DVD player? Which one would you put in the DVD player? The answer is so clear, it verges on a silly question, but let's consider the facts for fun. Both DVDs were cartoons. Both were age-appropriate for children. Both had a couple of good reviews on the packaging. The only difference is that we trust the DVD from Disney. Disney is not a perfect company. They occasionally have management and leadership issues. Their stock price sometimes goes down. They have lawsuits filed against them all the time. Some would lump them in with all the other nasty corporations that work to appease Wall Street. So why would we trust them? Disney operates with a clear sense of why. They exist to promote good, clean, family fun. And everything they say and do has, for decades, worked to prove it. The reason we trust Disney is simple. We know what they believe. They pass the celery test. They have been so consistent over time in everything they say and do that parents trust them enough to expose their children to Disney content without vetting it first. This has nothing to do with quality products. This is not rational. Southwest Airlines also passes the celery test. The company has been so consistent over time that we almost know what to expect from them. The airline only offers open seating on its flights, for example. It's one of the things they do to prove that they believe in freedom. It just makes sense. A company that serves the common man and values the equality for all so much could never have a class structure. If Delta or United or Continental tried to do the same, it wouldn't make sense. Open seating doesn't fit their why. In violation of celery. Birkenstock sandals, tie-dyed t-shirts, daisy chains, and a VW van. All are symbols of the hippie ideals of peace, love, and all things vegetarian. So it was a bit of a surprise in 2004 when Volkswagen introduced a $70,000 luxury model to their lineup. The company, famous for putting a vase for fresh flowers on the dashboard of their new Beetle, introduced the Phaeton in an attempt to compete with the high-end luxury cars, including the Mercedes-Benz S-Class and the BMW 7 Series. The V8 335-horsepower car boasted some of the most advanced features in the industry, like an air compressor suspension system and a draftless four-zone climate control. It even included an electronically controlled shiatsu massage system in the seats. The car was an astounding achievement. It was very comfortable, and it was a monster on the road, outperforming other, more established luxury cars in its class. The critics loved it. But there was a small problem. Despite all the facts and figures, features and benefits, regardless of the world-renowned German engineering, few people bought one. It just didn't make sense. What VW had done was inconsistent with what we know them to believe. Volkswagen, which translated means people's car, had spent generations making cars for you and me. Everyone knew what VW stood for. Power to the people. It brought its cause to life in products that were all about quality that the average person could afford. In a single swoop of German ingenuity, VW had been put completely out of balance. This is not like Dell coming out with an MP3 player, or United starting a low-cost airline like TED. In those cases, we had no idea what the company's why was. Absent any knowledge or feeling for their why, we couldn't bring ourselves to buy products from them that weren't anything beyond what they do. In this case, VW has a clear why, but what they'd produced was completely misaligned. They failed the celery test. Toyota and Honda knew this better than Volkswagen. When they decided to add luxury models to their lineups, they created new brands to do it, Lexus and Acura, respectively. Toyota had become a symbol of efficiency and affordability to the general population. They had built their business on a suite of low-cost cars. They knew that the market would never pay a premium for a luxury car with the same name or with the same logo on the hood. Although a luxury car, Lexus is still another what to Toyota's why. It still embodies the same cause as the Toyota-branded cars, and the values of the company are the same. The only difference is what they are doing to bring the cause to life. It serves a different market. That's all. The good news is, VW hasn't made the same mistake again, and their why remains clear. But if a company tries too many times to seize market opportunities that are inconsistent with their why, over time, their why will go fuzzier and fuzzier, and their ability to inspire and command loyalty will deteriorate. What companies say and do matters a lot. It is at the what level that a cause is brought to life. It is at this level that a company speaks to the outside world, and it is then that we can learn what the company believes. Part 5, Chapter 11, When Why Goes Fuzzy. Goliath flinched. A lot of what goes on these days with high-flying companies and these overpaid CEOs who are really just looting from the top and aren't watching out for anybody but themselves, it really upsets me. It's one of the main things wrong with American business today. This is the sentiment passed down from the founder of one of the most vilified companies in recent history. Raised on a farm in America's heartland, he came of age during the Great Depression. This probably explained his predisposition for frugality. Standing 5'9" and weighing only 130 pounds when he played football in high school, Sam Walton, the founder of Walmart, learned early the value of working hard. Working hard leads to winning, and as the quarterback on his high school football team, he won a lot. In fact, they went on to become the state champs. Whether through hard work, luck, or just an unflappable optimism, Walton got so used to winning all the time that he couldn't fully visualize what losing looked like. He simply couldn't imagine it. Walton even philosophized that always thinking about winning probably became a self-fulfilling prophecy for him. Even during the Depression, he had a highly successful paper route that earned him a decent wage for the times. By the time Sam Walton died, he had taken Walmart from a single store in Bentonville, Arkansas, and turned it into a retail colossus with $44 billion in annual sales and 40 million people shopping in the stores per week. But it takes more than a competitive nature and a strong work ethic and a sense of optimism to build a company big enough to equal the 23rd largest economy in the world. Walton wasn't the first person with big dreams to start a small business. Many small business owners dream of making it big. I meet a lot of entrepreneurs, and it is amazing to me how many of them tell me that their goal is to build a billion-dollar company. The odds, however, are significantly stacked against them. There are 27.7 million registered businesses in the United States today, and only 1,000 of them get to be Fortune 1000 companies, which these days requires about $1.5 billion in annual revenues. That means then fewer than 0.004% of all companies make it to the illustrious list. To have such an impact, to build a company to a size where it can drive markets, requires something more. Sam Walton did not invent the low-cost shopping model. The five-and-dime variety store concept had existed for decades, and Kmart and Target opened their doors the same year as Walmart in 1962. Discounting was already a $2 billion industry when Walton decided to build his first Walmart. There was plenty of competition beyond Kmart and Target, some of it much better funded and with better locations and seemingly better opportunities for success than Walmart. Sam Walton didn't even invent a better way of doing things than everyone else. He admitted to, quote-unquote, borrowing many of his ideas about the business from Sol Price, the founder of FedMart, a retail discounter founded in Southern California during the 1950s. Walmart was not the only retail establishment capable of offering low prices either. Price, as we've already established, is a highly effective manipulation. But it alone does not inspire people to root for you and give you the undying loyalty needed to create a tipping point to grow to massive proportions. Being cheap does not inspire employees to give their blood, sweat, and tears. Walmart did not have a lock on cheap prices, and cheap prices are not what made it so beloved and ultimately so successful. For Sam Walton, there was something else, a deeper purpose, a deeper cause or belief that drove him. More than anything else, Walton believed in people. He believed that if he looked after people, people would look after him. The more Walmart could give to employees, customers, and the community, the more that employees, customers, and the community would give back to Walmart. "We're all working together. That's the secret," said Walton. This was a much bigger concept than simply passing on the savings. To Walton, The inspiration came not simply from customer service, but from service itself. Walmart was what Walton built to serve his fellow human beings. To serve the community, to serve employees, and to serve customers. Service was a higher cause. The problem was that his cause was not clearly handed down after he died. In the post-Sam era, Walmart slowly started to confuse why it existed, to serve the people, with how it did business, to offer low prices. They traded the inspiring cause of serving people for a manipulation. They forgot Walton's why, and their driving motivation became all about cheap. In stark contrast to the founding cause that Walmart originally embodied, efficiency and margins became the name of the game. A computer can tell you down to the dime what you've sold, but it can never tell you how much you could have sold, said Walton. There's always a price to pay for the money you make, and given Walmart's sheer size, that cost wasn't paid in dollars and cents alone. In Walmart's case, forgetting their founder's why has come at a very high human cost. Ironic, considering the company's founding cause. The company, once renowned for how it treated employees and customers, has been scandal-ridden for nearly a decade. Nearly every scandal has centered on how poorly they treat their customers and their employees. As of December 2008, Walmart faced 73 class action lawsuits, all related to wage violations, and has already paid hundreds of millions of dollars in past judgments and settlements. A company that believed in the symbiotic relationship between corporation and community managed to drive a wedge between themselves and so many of the communities in which they operate. There was a time when legislation would have passed laws to allow Walmart into new communities. Now, lawmakers rally to keep them out. Fights to block Walmart from opening new stores have erupted across the country. In New York, for example, city representatives in Brooklyn joined forces with labor unions to block the stores because of Walmart's reputation for unfair labor practices. In one of the more ironic violations of Walton's founding beliefs, Walmart has been unable to laugh at itself or learn from its scandals. Celebrate your successes, said Walton, and find some humor in your failures. Don't take yourself so seriously. Loosen up, and everyone around you will loosen up. Instead of admitting that things aren't what they used to be, Walmart has done the opposite. The way Walmart thinks, acts, and communicates since the passing of their inspired leader is not as a result of competitors outsmarting them either. Kmart filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection in 2002, and then merged with Sears 3 years later. With about $400 billion in annual sales, Walmart still sells more than six times as much as Target each year. In fact, looking beyond discount retailing, Walmart is now the largest supermarket in the world and sells more DVDs, bicycles, and toys than any other company in America. Outside competition is not what's hurting the company. The greatest challenge Walmart has faced over the years comes from one place, itself. For Walmart, what they do and how they do it hasn't changed. And it has nothing to do with Walmart being a corporation. They were one of those before the love started to decline. What has changed is that their why went fuzzy. And we all know it. A company once so loved is simply not as loved anymore. The negative feelings we have for the company are real. But the part of the brain that is able to explain why we feel so negatively towards them has trouble explaining what changed. So we rationalize and point to the most tangible things we can see. Size and money. If we, as outsiders, have lost clarity of Walmart's why, it's a good sign that the why has gone fuzzy inside the company also. If it's not clear on the inside, it'll never be clear on the outside. What is clear is that the Walmart of today is not the Walmart that Sam Walton built. So what happened? It's too easy to say that all they care about is the bottom line. All companies are in business to make money, but being successful at it is not the reason why things change so drastically. That only points to a symptom. Without understanding the reason it happened in the first place, the pattern will repeat for every other company that makes it big. Being successful versus feeling successful. Every year, a group of high-performing entrepreneurs get together at MIT's Endicott House, just outside Boston. This gathering of titans, as they call themselves, is not your average entrepreneurial conference. It's not a boondoggle, there's no golf, There's no spa, and there are no expensive dinners. Every year, 40 to 50 business owners spend 4 days listening, from early in the morning until well into the evening. An assortment of guest speakers is invited to present their thinking and ideas, and then there are discussions led by some of the attendees. I had the honor of attending the Gathering of Titans as a guest a few years ago. I expected it to be another group of entrepreneurs getting together to talk shop. I expected to hear discussions and presentations about maximizing profits and improving systems. But what I witnessed was profoundly different. In fact, it was the complete opposite. On the first day, someone asked the group how many of them had achieved their financial goals. About 80% of the hands went up. I thought that alone was quite impressive. But it was the answer to the next question that was so profound. With their hands still in the air, the group was asked, "How many of you feel successful?" And 80% of the hands went down. Here was a room full of some of America's brightest entrepreneurs, many of them multimillionaires, some of whom don't need to work anymore if they don't want to. Yet most of them still didn't feel like they had succeeded. In fact, many of them reported that they had lost something since they started their businesses. They reminisced about the days when they didn't have any money and were working out of their basements trying to get things going. They longed for the feeling they used to have. These amazing entrepreneurs were at a point in their lives where they realized that their businesses were about much more than selling stuff or making money. They realized the deep personal connection that existed between what they do and why they do it. This group of entrepreneurs gathered to discuss matters of why, and at times it was quite intense. Unlike the typical type A personality entrepreneurs, the Titans were not there to prove anything to each other. There was a feeling of immense trust rather than a ruthless competition. And because of this feeling, every member of the group was willing to express vulnerability that they probably rarely let show the rest of the year. Over the course of the event, every person in the room would shed a tear at least once or twice. It doesn't interest me to write about the idea that money doesn't buy happiness, or in this case, the feeling of success. This is neither profound nor a new idea. What does interest me, however, is the transition that these entrepreneurs went through. As their companies grew and they became more and more successful, what changed? It is easy to see what they gained over the course of their careers. We can easily count the money, the size of the office, the number of employees, the size of their homes, market share, and the number of press clippings. But the thing that they had lost is much harder to identify. As their tangible success grew, something elusive started to dissipate. Every single one of these successful business owners knew what they did. They knew how they did it. But for many, they no longer knew why. Achievement versus success. For many people, there is an irony to success. Many people who achieve great success don't always feel it. Some who achieve fame talk about the loneliness that often goes with it. That's because success and achievement are not the same thing. Yet too often we mistake one for the other. Achievement is something you reach or attain, like a goal. It is something tangible, clearly defined, and measurable. Success, in contrast, is a feeling or a state of being. She feels successful. She is successful, we say using the verb to be to suggest this state of being. While we can easily lay down a path to reach a goal, laying down a path to reach that intangible feeling of success is more elusive. In my vernacular, achievement comes when you pursue and attain what you want. Success comes when you are clear in pursuit of why you want it. The former is motivated by tangible factors, while the latter is something deeper in the brain, where we lack the capacity to put those feelings into words. Success comes when we wake up every day in that never-ending pursuit of why we do what we do. Our achievements, what we do, serve as the milestones to indicate that we're on the right path. It is not an either-or. We need both. A wise man once said, "Money can't buy happiness, but it pays for the yacht to pull alongside of it." There is great truth in this statement. The yacht represents achievement. It is easily seen and, with a plan, completely attainable. The thing we pull alongside represents that hard-to-define feeling of success. Obviously, this is much harder to see and attain. They are distinct concepts. Sometimes they go together, and sometimes they don't. More importantly, some people, while in pursuit of success, simply mistake what they achieve as the final destination. This is the reason they never feel satisfied, no matter how big their yacht is, no matter how much they achieve. The false assumption we often make is that if we simply achieve more, the feeling of success will follow, but it rarely does. In the course of building a business or a career, we become more confident in what we do. We become greater experts in how we do it. With each achievement, the tangible measurements of success and the feeling of progress increase. Life is good. However, for most of us, somewhere in the journey we forget why we set out on the journey in the first place. Somewhere, in the course of all those achievements, an inevitable split happens. This is true for individuals and organizations alike. What the Endicott entrepreneurs experienced as individuals was the same transition that Walmart and other big companies either have gone through or are going through. Because Walmart operates at such an immense scale, the impact of their fuzzy why is felt on a greater scale. Employees, customers, and the community will also feel it. Those with an ability to never lose sight of why, no matter how little or how much they achieve, can inspire us. Those with the ability to never lose sight of why and also achieve the milestones that keep everyone focused in the right direction, those are the great leaders. For great leaders, the golden circle is in balance. They are in pursuit of why, they hold themselves accountable to how they do it, and what they do serves as the tangible proof of what they believe. But most of us, unfortunately, reach a place where what we are doing and why we are doing it eventually fall out of balance. We get to a point where why and what are no longer aligned. It is the separation of the tangible and the intangible that marks the split.